Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Ender. Now then, I've come up with a brand new game which could well sweep the world. It could be the new X Factor for all we know. It's called Snooker Player Bingo. And what I did was I wrote down 20 snooker players, past and present. I allotted them all a number from 1 to 20. I gathered Phil Yates and Neil Foulds, and indeed Alan McManus, because Alan sort of stumbled into it, not knowing what we were doing, and I invited him to take part. Basically, they named a number and then corresponded to the player, and we just had stories and anecdotes about that player. It's a very simple concept, and I think it goes pretty well. We had a lot of fun doing it, and hopefully you'll have a lot of fun listening to it. Okay, Neil, you can go first. Pick a number.
14.
Number 14, straight away, it's a contemporary, Danny Fowler.
Danny Fowler, Dustbin Danny. I played him, actually. He was a bit of a bogey player for me. I played him in the UK Championship qualifiers in my second season as a professional. And as I say, as an amateur, he'd beat me a couple of times. And I played at Stockport in the little Masters Club in there. And at the interval, I was 5-3 up, first to nine, obviously UK, as it was then. And then the referee was a guy called Nobby Clark. He decided that I was late for the evening session. He thought it was a 7 o'clock start, even though it was 7:30. And this argument went on. I docked two frames. It took about an hour to get the frames.
I didn't think we started with this acrimony. I thought this was going to be like a friendly chat.
My dad actually had to phone up the WSA office. Clearly nobody was there that time of night. And in the end, I got my frames back, but lost the match.
Wow.
And afterwards, they actually said to me, the WSA said wrongly, they said to me, you can have the match replayed if you want. But of course, the moment had gone. So that's my memory of Danny Fowler.
Dustbin Danny, I mean, he was a dustman.
Well, he was, and I remember on one occasion he beat Martin Clark in the UK Championship, and the headline in the local paper, the Express and Star, was Dustbin Danny dumps Dismal Clark, which was alliteration taken to the extreme. Yeah. Two things I remember about Fowler. He was very unlucky in a ranking event semi-final against Stephen Hendry, who fluked the brown against him. Hendry beat him, I think it was 5-4. The other thing I remember off table was the fact that his manager was involved in a major altercation with Alex Higgins over in Dubai.
That's not unusual, though, in fairness. People were.
No, but this was involved being in the pool. Yeah. And this guy was so annoyed with him, and he could handle himself as well. This guy was so annoyed with Higgins that basically he was ducking him under the pool, and Higgins couldn't swim. And every time Higgins came up, he issued a particular expletive, and this guy was ducking him back under the...
Alex Higgins might feature...
Yeah. I think he's 1 to 20, actually.
I think he's working on an organic farm somewhere in the Midlands or something. That's what I heard.
Danny
about
Fowler?
That. Yeah, I heard that, yeah. I don't, it could be rubbish, but that's what I heard.
Maybe he's listening. Okay, Phil, you pick a number.
17.
One of the legends of the game, Doug Mountjoy.
There's lots of stories about Doug, aren't there? When I played him in the World Championship and I beat him by that record score, it sounds like I'm bigging myself up when saying that. I beat him 13-1 and he was about to change his game at that point. He was in the middle. Frank Callan had got onto him and he was dreadful in that match, really poor. And then later on in the year, I played him again in the UK Championship. So it was the same year, but a different season. And you can imagine it's like, what are we talking, April through to November. Anyway, Doug's turned up. I thought, just beating him 31 in the world, you know, it's going to be all right. And he's still doing he's still got the Frank Callan new Q action going. Played marvellous against me, beat me 9-4. And I thought, well, this is, how bad can you get? How can you beat someone so comfortably and lose so heavily? I remember opening the almost smashing the door down of the guild hall, trying to get out of the arena, saying this is an all-time low. And of course, what happens? Goes on and wins three consecutive centuries against Hendry, no less, in the final. So it wasn't me, it was him, as they say.
Neil doesn't remember this, but I do. At that World Championship, when Neil beat him with a session to spare, at one point the cue ball was under the cushion and he actually topped it. It was just awful.
It's almost a miss, an air shot almost.
The technique had completely gone, and what Frank did was remarkable. He just completely reinvigorated Doug's game. And everyone thinks, well, he was 46, he won the UK Championship in 1988, fantastic, and it was. But it was the way he played. Stephen didn't play badly in that final at all. As Neil said, Doug made three consecutive centuries. He was amazing, and then he won the next world ranking event as well, the Mercantile Credit Classic, beating Wayne Jones in the final. So to win two in succession at the age of 46, one of the great achievements.
Golden spell for him, wasn't it?
And arguably, I mean, it's difficult to compare eras, but arguably one of the best players not to be world champion. He won the Masters, he won the UK, and of his time he was one of the top players.
And for a while, he had the highest break ever in the World Championship, 145, and he got to a final as well. Of course, he was the victim when Steve won the first of his six world titles. Absolutely, one of the best players never to win the world title, although he did win the World Amateur Championship. Mm.
This isn't funny in a way, but I'll tell it anyway. It might be funny in retrospect. He did some, of course, he was very ill. He had a lung removed, but he did some coaching for World Snooker, and he was out in Malta one year at the venue there, and every day he had to climb up about 40 steps to get to the top level where he was coaching, and of course it took a lot out of him because he only had one lung, couldn't breathe properly. It would take about 5 minutes to recover. And on the last day, someone very cheerily said to him, "You know, there's a lift, Doug." I thought, why didn't you tell him on the first day, the poor old soul? Anyway, that's Doug Mountjoy, still going strong. He practices still in Mark Williams' club.
Saw him at the World Seniors a couple of years ago, you know, and we spoke about a couple of matches because he beat me at the Crucible the year after I beat Alex Higgins. Yeah. He beat me heavily, absolutely all over me. And I spoke about this at this World Seniors a couple of years back. He had no recollection of us ever playing.
Well, if he's listening, then maybe that'll jog his memory.
Yeah, just because he's not bothered about the past.
OK, Neil, your turn.
Two.
John Virgo. Now, the reason he's on the list is a lot of people know John Virgo, obviously, as a commentator. They know him from Big Break. But we shouldn't ignore his playing career. He was a UK champion.
He was a great snooker player. I used to practice with him a lot. And I learnt an awful lot from John. As you say, he's almost someone that you've forgotten about. Having ever played, it was all about Big Break and all of that and the funny waistcoats and what he is now. I think he's a really terrific summariser, actually. I really enjoy listening to John right now. But as a player, break building, absolutely top class.
Well, I've been fortunate to work with John on a very limited basis doing commentary. And it's anything when you work with people, you appreciate just how knowledgeable they are. And I really enjoyed the experience, and I think he's excellent, yeah. And I think the other thing about him is, even though, you know, he's been doing the media side of the game for years, he's still genuinely enthusiastic, and that comes through in his commentary, which I love. Two things about him as a player. One, he was very right-eyed, wasn't he? You know, the master eye was right-eyed, and he was on that side with the cue. The other was the fact that when he won the UK Championship, he did so despite being docked frames.
That's right, against Terry in the final.
Got the time wrong.
Yeah, because there'd been all kinds of issues with a TV strike and things like that, and then the final began at a completely different time to all of the rest of the matches, and I think he was docked two frames, and yet he won the match regardless.
I saw him play. The first time I actually went to the Crucible to watch, it was him against Gary Wilkinson. They were last-minute tickets, I've got to be honest. And it was excruciating. Four frames to the interval, absolutely just terrible. Neither could pot a ball. And when they went to the interval, one of the lights, you know, the famous lights in the Crucible, popped. It was like a loud bang, and some wag in the crowd shouted, "John Virgo's just shot himself," because he'd lost the first four frames. That's what was known as banter in those days.
just one more thing about him. I have to say this, because when I was like just starting to do a few exhibitions, it was always a thing that you had to do trick shots. And as a youngster, I was terrified of the thought of doing them. And one day, my dad said that John has offered to come into the club for a day and go through all of his trick shot repertoire and teach them all. And he did that for me. I thought it was really kind of him. Did for nothing. You know, all the shots, a few ways of setting them up, but I'll never forget that.
Actually, his impressions of the players were funny. Like, people bring them up now almost like as sort of, those old days. They were actually really good.
The other thing I remember about him, of course, a former chairman of the WPBSA, and it was at the time when we had that European Open in Deauville, which was a complete disaster, calamity. There was no one there. Yeah. Northern France in 1989. There wouldn't be anybody in Northern France maybe now, but back then, literally nobody in the arenas at all. And I'm doing this piece, I think it was to the Daily Express, and I was putting it through to copy at the time because there was no email back then. And I'm doing this really critical piece about why did they bring the tournament here. I put the phone down on the copy table. Okay, thanks, great, cheers. Put the phone down, look around, there's John listening to every word I've said. I've been slagging off his regime. Oh, yeah.
And yet they still allow you into venues.
And at that same tournament, he played Eddie Charlton. And Eddie played excruciatingly slowly.
Unusually for him.
Yeah, yes. And in the last frame, he cleared up. And it was one of those where he cleared up into one particular side of the table. So it's blue into the left middle, pink and black into the other, the left top pocket. And when he's on the blue and Virgo knows he's going to lose, he just walks out. So Eddie pots the balls to win, turns around to shake his hand, and he wasn't there.
Yeah. Okay, Phil, it's your turn.
Hello, lads.
Hi, Alan. We're recording a podcast, but feel free to join in. No, we are. No, seriously. We're just talking about play. In fact, you're on this list, actually. Oh, but anyway, go.
Oh, he's on the list.
Yeah. Pick a number. Okay, I'll say number seven.
Gary Wilkinson. I'll just explain to Alan what we're doing. Alan McManus joins us, by the way.
Hi,
basically,
guys.
I've written down a list of players, past and present, and we're literally just telling stories about them.
Oh, okay.
So,
well, Gary Wilkinson, the thing I remember now, and I'm pretty sure it was when he played Steve Davis in the UK Championship. Did he beat Jimmy White 9-0?
Yep.
First of all.
Yep.
And he had Davis beaten, and it got down to the pink and black. Correct me if I'm wrong. And Steve needed a snooker.
But Gary didn't know.
Yeah. I've never known that before. He was about 14 or 15 in front. And he played the pink at long range really, really thin to play the safety shot when he didn't need to do it. And he missed it. And then, of course, he lost the match. And apparently, after the match, he tells a story that he was asked to sign all the programmes, still oblivious to the fact that Steve needed a snooker in the first place, and he'd given away this foul for no obvious reason. And he threw all the programmes on the floor. He couldn't believe it. He didn't know.
Yeah, he was told, and it was confirmed to him at the press conference, and he just went ashen. It was terrible, terrible. I mean, he genuinely thought he needed to hit that pink thin.
I actually remember the shot, the pink. I'm sure the pink was on the bulk cushion.
It was.
The white was in the black end, yes. And he's missed it, and then...
Yes. The thing with Wilkinson, I mean, he won the World Match Play, which is a very good tournament to win at the time, came close to winning the British Open. He was 6-3 up on Stephen Hendry in the final, eventually lost 10-9. He was a very, very tough match player. Towards the end of his career, I think he became sort of full of indecision, and consequently he became quite slow, but a really formidable player who was in the, not just in the top 16, but in the top 8. And if you can get there in the era he was playing, you've got to be able to play the game very, very well. But you've got the best Gary Wilkinson story.
Well, you say he became quite slow. Is this Jason Ferguson?
Yes.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
I know what's coming.
Because this was the final qualifier for the World Championship years ago. I'd only just started out and was being sort of, you know, thought I should actually attend and not sort of leave early like everyone else did. Little knowing that they started the final session at 6 o'clock. It was still going at 1 o'clock in the morning. Bruce Beckett, who was then the World Snooker press officer, went in to have a look, because the last frame seemed to have been going a long time. And he's come out after about 20 minutes. He said, this ain't going anywhere. There's 5 reds on the top cushion. Wow. They're just playing off them. It lasted about 80 minutes, the last frame. Finished about 20 to 2 in the morning.
It's pretty evil, isn't it?
And I waited for the quotes. There were no quotes, obviously. I said to Gary, yeah, well, you must be really happy you qualified. And I said, but it took a long time, didn't it? He said, well, it don't matter how you get there. And that was it. Got in his car, drove home.
But Dave wasn't the only spectator.
Oh no, I think he was basically a tramp. I mean, let's not be coy. He's basically a tramp coming to shelter from the weather outside. And
eventually he left.
He was 8 each. He went home. Yeah. Yeah. So that was the audience. Okay. Well, Alan, you choose a number. 1 to 20.
17.
We've had that. You weren't here for that.
Okay. 11.
11 is Tony Drago. Well, of course. Well, actually, of course. In recent times, Alan, you sort of featured slightly in a Tony Drago story.
Wow. Yeah, I think we've all got stories with a tornado in it. The one at Sheffield, in the, I think it was a German qualifier or something, and obviously it was 4 each, and he conceded basically when he could still win,
yeah.
And he's left me the blue, which is...
And he's realised he's going to be fined, because that's the rule, isn't it?
Well, he actually didn't realise was going to be fined. The referee kind of said to him, and then Tony sort of, I thought...
It's not what you do, is it?
Oh, right, OK. Well, now can you maybe retract the you know... But, look, the point of it was at the time, if you're playing out there and a guy shakes your hand and gets my cue's mentally and physically in my cue case,
yeah,
it's not not coming back out. And but, you know, obviously... we've all seen the footage of Tony on.
Well, if you haven't seen it, he punched himself in the face. Yeah, and that's what he did.
Good punch as well.
It was a good punch. But look, the funny thing about it was, I was now driving back home up the A66, and my phone went, and it was Tony. He said, "Oh, Alan, listen, I'm really sorry about what happened," and da da da. But he said, "The thing is, we should know better." So what do you mean we? But that's just Tony, and you know, it was a good story.
I think it's fair to say, if you get on a plane, you don't want to see Tony sit down next to you, because he's a very nervous flyer.
Yeah,
he's pretty terrified of that, isn't he? And the other thing about Tony, I recently only found out that Jimmy White gives him a ring quite a lot. He finds him up almost every day at the World Championships. When I was with you guys, Eurosport, Jimmy phones Tony, and if you're listening, Tony, it's all in good fun. He enjoys his food. There's no getting away from that. He really loves his food. He's either eating or watching the snooker. You can be certain of one thing. Tony will be watching the match. And Jimmy says, hey, what do you think the match is going? Yeah, let me tell you, Jimmy, I think this, that and the other. He's never anywhere else but watching or having his dinner, you know. And I really miss him this year, actually. Not on the tour. Didn't make it through Q School, and it's a real shame. Hope he gets back.
He was a real hothead. I mean, even late in his career, I remember the World Seniors down in Portsmouth. He'd lost, I think, to Tony Chappell. And,
I think it might have been
Dave Harold, that's right. He'd lost the match to Dave Harold. Come upstairs, and the guy he's with, all he said to him was, bad luck. That unleashed a tirade that went on for about 5 minutes. Totally unwarranted. What I will say about Drago, though, I don't think there's ever been a player whose best and whose worst is so far apart. At his best, he was unstoppable.
Brilliant player.
He played John Parrott in the British Open at Derby at the Assembly Rooms. I think it was in the last 16, and he won 5-1, and no one would have beaten him that night. I was actually in the arena. It was impossible to beat him the way he played. You couldn't leave him safe. He knocked everything in, and he played good safety himself. And you think, well, he could go on and win this. And the next round, no good at all. But at his best, he was simply inspirational.
OK, Neil, number?
Four.
Number four is Dave Harold, who we've just mentioned.
Dave Harold.
Stoke Potter.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember playing him in the UK Championship one year, and Jan Verhaas, it was quite early in Jan's refereeing career, I think, and the Mistral was quite in its infancy as well, and I was called a miss, which was actually absolutely the correct decision, but I was not quite, and a miss where I was trying to hit a reds, and I hit the black on the way through, and the reds went all over the table. Because Dave and is trying to get the balls replaced and all that, and Jan said to me, Neil, would you like to help me? I said, listen, you call a miss, you put them back, I'm going to sit there. And Dave just looked at me, and he found quite, and I still speak with Jan about it, but Dave was that kind of character. I found him quite frustrating to play. I played him in the World Championship the last time I got to the Crucible as a qualifier. I thought, this is a good draw, and Dave played brilliantly against me. He's a very good player, one of the toughest guys to beat. I never got to know him very well off the table, actually. But I think he enjoyed a drink. He's a good lad, and another guy that's missed from the tour. Yeah.
Strangely enough, the history that I've got with Dave Harold goes back a long way, and what I'm going to say about it as a match I played him, it was actually to turn professional. It was best of nine at Blackpool, summer of 90, and the winner turned pro and the loser went home, and that was basically it. That just obviously doesn't happen these days. I was the lucky one to come through, but it was good days. I remember him well.
Got to a final, obviously, of the Grand Prix, losing to John Higgins. He won a ranking event as well as a 500 to one outside of the old Asian Open in Bangkok. Beat Darren Morgan in the final.
And he played brilliant, didn't he?
And he played absolutely superbly throughout that tournament. The conditions weren't the best, I thought, because he not got a great amount of power because of his cue action, he would really suffer there, but he didn't. He got stuck in and he beat some very, very good players, ended up winning the title. And it's a statistic we always come out with, a story we always come out with, but his brother had a tenner on him at 500 to 1.
Oh,
how about that?
He was also the opponent when Stephen Hendry broke his arm at the Crucible. Dave was his opponent. Now, you'd imagine hearing that news, he'd be jumping for joy, but of course, I think he absolutely hammered him, didn't he?
Well, Stephen was 7-1 up overnight, and I was very fortunate, and I thank him to this day. A member of Stephen's team actually rang me and told me he'd broken his arm, so I actually broke the story on Radio 5, and I'm really worried for Stephen, because you don't want to see anybody lose in the World Championship under those circumstances. And he came back out and he played so gingerly in the first frame of the day, lost it, and you think, oh no, you know, this is going to be a nightmare. And then the next frame he had a big century and ended up winning 13-2. That's how good he was, Hendry.
Yeah, but Dave was really happy with that. Go on, Phil.
I'll go for number one,
Fred Davis.
Well, a legend. I mean, one of the all-time greats. Where would we start with Fred?
Well, I've got really only one story quickly with Fred. I think I was present in his last match as a professional. I might have been. It was at the Nordbrek, and I think it was a guy from Leeds, Chris Cookson, who you'll obviously remember.
He's from Preston.
Preston.
Get it right, Alan.
Chris, I think, beat him 10-1, and Fred came out from the auditorium. He came out into the practice area. There was about six practice tables, and there was probably half a dozen guys practicing and maybe 50 guys scattered around the room. It was a big room. And everyone sort of stopped and sort of the applause. And, you know, so he was a grand old man of the game, wasn't he?
Never used to practice, apparently. Someone told him in the last few years he used to play matches. He had the same cue all his career also.
Yeah.
which, as I remember it, towards the end of his career, it looked like he'd had it all his career. It looked like a really, really old cue. But he was, you know, one of the last of that generation, wasn't he? He was a great snooker player. A great player. I watched him in the qualifiers towards the end of his playing career as well. And in amongst them, he was still really, really good. But at long range, of course, he'd lost it by then.
Well, when Alan got to the semi-final of the World Championship this year, I mean, a phenomenal achievement. 45, weren't you, at the time, obviously. Now everyone's saying, how can a 45-year-old get to the semi-final of the World Championship? Well, in 1978, Fred was 64 yeah. when he got to the semi-final. Yeah. And I absolutely, to this day, will say he should have got to the final. He should have beaten Perry Mans. He missed that pink. You know, he could have easily got to the final. And that... you can't quite comprehend
yeah,
that.
It would have been quite something. Yeah.
There's footage on YouTube of, I think it's the year after, so it was 79, he makes a century at the Crucible, and at the end, the referee applauds.
That's right.
Just so impressed. He thought he would have been 65.
Yes, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And also billiards, I mean, he was a world billiards champion.
Just an amazing person.
When, but in the shadow of his brother, you can't get away from that. Obviously, Joe Davis was the first world champion, 15 times world champion.
I wasn't alive in 1946. Right, okay.
Just to clear that up.
I wasn't there. I wasn't there. But, you know, Fred was getting closer and closer and closer to Joe. Mm. And I think Joe retired because he was not frightened, but he didn't want to lose his unbeaten record as world champion. And I think Fred was the reason he retired from the world championship.
Yeah. Okay. Alan, would you like to choose a number?
Nine.
Number nine. Well, this person's on this list for one reason only. Maureen McCarthy, Phil. Off you go.
Okay. Maureen McCarthy... Nobody knew who she was. Even the members of the women's circuit didn't know who she was. She appeared on the list for the Benson & Hedges Championship, which was the satellite tournament. The winner of it got into the Benson & Hedges Masters, and it was played in various locations. Obviously up in Scotland, I remember famously, and then it moved down to Malvern. And she was on the list, and we're thinking, who on earth is she? You know, is she some kind of... amazing player who's never bothered to enter a women's tournament because she's too good for them. You know, she's going to blitz them. Men, what kind of player is she?
Turned out she wasn't.
She played a gentleman who we all know very well, Mike Dunn, and I think she scored 2 points in the whole match,
yeah.
which is the lowest ever score in a best of nine. I think Mark King holds the record for the lowest ever points scored in a televised best of nine against John Higgins, 11. But she scored 2 points.
Well, she did, and she earned herself, probably didn't know this, but she earned herself a rather clever nickname because one of the tournament officials, because he had the sheet, the marker sheet, and it was like 0010, and her nickname was Binary. Which is kind of something, I don't know. But then, she moved to Malvern, where the tournament was held, to practice for the next year.
That's right, yeah. I think it was at the Willie Thorne...
Took it seriously.
Willie Thorne Snooker Centre.
Taking things very seriously.
Yeah, and she actually moved to Malvern to practice, but she didn't play the following year for some reason.
No, well, I don't know.
Anyway, yeah. Okay. But 2 points in a match, that takes some beating.
She's in the record books. Neil?
13.
13 is Darren Morgan. But, of course, he was beaten by Dave Harold in that final that you mentioned.
He was. Darren Morgan is another one because he was always saying he was going to retire, more so than even Ronnie, and you know, said that quite a lot in recent years and other players. Almost every tournament Darren played, he said, this is my last one. You know, just after he lost by some miracle, you know, maybe that's not coincidental. This is I'm finishing playing. Shook hands with me, and you know, great to see you. This is my career over. And of course, not only would he appear at the next tournament, and as if it had never happened, and at the end of it, when he lost, if he lost, he'd say, this is my last tournament for sure. Of course, now he still plays when he doesn't have to.
He's been in the semi-final.
He's one of the sort of like leading seniors players going. So basically, he doesn't always mean everything he says. I think all of us have felt like we want to pack it in when we lose. But Darren used to go to the point of shaking hands and saying his goodbyes and then reappearing. So that's what I think about Darren. Great character.
Character.
There was one a couple of years ago, I think, from Darren that you guys might know some about. Probably you do, Phil. It was at one of the European senior over 40s event amateur thing, and I think he was with, was it Phil Williams or what?
Yes.
One of the Welsh guys, and they were rooming, and I think Phil Williams either beat him in the semi-final or the final, and they got back to the room and he said, and Darren turned round and said, thanks very much, you've just ruined my Christmas.
Yeah.
So they didn't speak a lot for the rest of the stay, but that's Darren.
Well, very competitive, and I still miss him on the circuit. Great fun to be around. he asked me once, he was doing some commentary when he started out, what should I do in the commentary box? I said, Darren, just be yourself and say it as it is. And when he does commentate, that's what he does, and that's why I like to hear him. You know, he's got these opinions, whether they're right or wrong, so what? He's got his opinions and he'll say them, and I respect him for that. The best Darren Morgan story for me, he always thought that he wasn't given the respect that he was due. He got that in his head. And on one occasion, for the first time, he got into the world's top eight, and he was absolutely over the moon. And the first tournament of the year was Dubai, and we went to the Al Nasser Stadium. He used to go over that big bridge across the creek and turn right into the car park there. And he, this is it now, they can't deny me now, I'm in the top eight, all this kind of stuff. We turn up at this Al Nasser Stadium for this Dubai Classic, and there's this massive poster along the length of the venue, the Magnificent Seven, and he was the one who was missed out. He was steam coming out of the ears.
But also, he won the Irish Masters, didn't he? He won the Irish Masters. I think he then got to the final the year after, and then they never asked him back again.
That was absolutely disgraceful. He won it one year, he lost 9-8 on the black the next year, and he was never invited back. Mm. And also, he did win quite a few tournaments over the years that were discontinued.
Yes, he'll tell you all about them if you sit down. Yeah. We'll do one more, because I know you gentlemen have got to go and work, earn a proper living. Alan, see if you can pick yourself.
Five.
You have done, but I don't think we should talk about you as you're here, because that's a bit embarrassing. Pick another number.
Ten.
Number ten, well, one of the all-time greats, Terry Griffiths.
Well, it could take a long time speaking about the Griff. No, I mean, I've known him a long time since my dad played him, actually, in the English Amateur Championships and beat him, my dad did, actually. And this is going back to, the mid-70s. And it became apparent what a great player he was. He was beating Patsy Fagan at the time, and no-one used to beat Patsy in London. But he was playing English Amateur Championship as a Welshman, which a few people found a bit strange, but that's the way that it was. I've known him ever since, and there were too many stories to tell, but he's truly one of the legends of the game for me. Do anything for you, and he is kind of Mr. Snooker for me.
There was a couple of ones for me, actually, when I first turned pro and then recently. My debut at the Crucible, Terry beat me. I think it was 13, 11 or 12 anyway, and I was pretty devastated. I can normally let go of a defeat, but I was crying in the dressing room after the match, only really because the guy I was with started bubbling, so I blame him. But then, funny enough, this year, when Ding hammered me at the Crucible, Griff actually came in the dressing room and he sort of gave us a hug. And you know, the way he does, he's like that. He's that kind of guy. He gets emotional, and I'm not attached to Terry in any way. You know, he's a good guy, and he kind of gave us a hug, and he kind of had a bit of a tear in his eye. And I, funny enough, almost had a bit of a tear dripping myself, just because of the way it was quite emotional, and he's that kind of guy. And so it was funny from the start of my career at the Crucible to literally maybe the end of it. Terry was there, and it was a nice memory to have, you know.
Sure.
Well, I'm sitting around the table with three of the people I respect a lot in the game, and Terry's in that group as well. You know, how can you not like the guy? He's just such a genuinely warm individual, and when you're around him, he's funny.
Extremely dry sense of humour.
Yeah, but he's also very, very caring, as Alan's just said, and he's not selfish in any way. He's actually not like a really good world champion. He's not self-absorbed at all, is he? You know, he's very caring about other people. So that I love about him. But the other thing you've got to say is when he won that championship in 79, he played fantastically. The amount of frames he won from well behind with lovely clearances, it was one of the great performances for me. And when you think that in his previous professional match before that championship was in the UK qualifiers, and he'd lost it 9-8 to Rex Williams after being 8-2 up, and then he goes to the Crucible and does that. Astonishing.
Yes, and also now, just finally, now he's become a coach. There are certain people who have become attached to players in various capacities down the years who, let's face it, quite like the limelight and quite like to sort of be mentioned and so on. He's the opposite. He stays in the background because, of course, he's got nothing to prove. He's done it all himself. So I have every respect for him as well. Thank you to you all for your comments.
But with Terry, I was fortunate enough. We're talking about him being a nice guy, a caring guy, and he is. I had been pro about 2 or 3 years, and he actually invited me down. He stayed in Llanelli at the time, and invited me down to the house, and I stayed overnight with him 2 or 3 nights, done a little exhibition in the Matchroom Club, and he'd one of these big fancy houses with the fountain in the driveway, and it was like a roundabout and all that sort of stuff. It was funny, in the morning I was in it was literally a guest room. It was like Southport Branch. So the phone's gone. I've picked up the phone, it's at the side of the bed, so it was a bit like a big hotel room, fancy. phone's going. I picked up, and it was Terry. He was in the kitchen. He said, "Breakfast is ready." And, you know, it was a big, massive house, but it was fantastic. And actually, the snooker room he had on the end of the house, I don't know if any of you guys ever got the chance to
be there. We weren't obviously as close to him as you, I thought I knew him really well. It turns out I was never invited to that house. Nothing like that happened.
His snooker room attached to the side of the house is maybe the nicest snooker room I've ever seen in my life. It was Chesterfield suite, big mahogany bar, gantry, table immaculate, and it was the table that he beat Jimmy in the semis of 89, the semi-final table at the Crucible. And it was there was a white on the end of the table where you normally see the Riley or BCE sign. There was just a white piece of paper, and it was signed by Jimmy White. And so that he held Jimmy in great esteem, didn't he? And,
yes.
You know, so that was a personal thing for him.
And that's the other thing we've got to remember about Terry. Didn't just win the World Championship, he won the majors.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, this has been a little bit like an episode of Parkinson, a very niche one, it's got to be said. But thank you all, and we'll see you next time.